You're listening to a Speech Therapy PD podcast. Earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode by completing the accompanying course online at speechtherapypd.com.
Welcome to the Speech Link. I'm your host, Sharp Beauchart, and I invite you to listen and learn practical strategies from experienced experts to take your therapy to the next level. Getting a child to say a good er sound is one thing, but getting them to use it consistently is another. Now, you know the Easy R program for getting the er, but what about generalization? Well, what about the new R speech practice audios? Kids love to practice them, and you quickly access them via QR codes. Go to speechdynamics.com to take advantage of the 40% off sale price. Do it now. Before we get started, I would like to mention some disclosures. Regarding financial disclosures, Dr. Zhik receives an honorarium for this podcast from speechtherapypd.com. I also receive an honorarium for the Speech Link, and I am a presenter for speechtherapypd.com, and I receive royalties, and I also own Speech Dynamics. Neither of us have non-financial disclosures, so there you have it. Okay. Welcome, everybody, to our live Speech Link podcast, sponsored, of course, by SpeechTherapyPD.com. And welcome to Posture, the Missing Piece in Speech Production. You are more than welcome to participate. Just type your question or your comment into the chat, and when appropriate, one of us will read it, and our esteemed guest will respond. I'm Shar Beauchart, your speech-language pathologist host, where the goal is to connect and link with outstanding professionals related to our field. Now, today is a very special episode. It is a research studies and practical strategies podcast where the goal is to merge the two. The intent is for practical-oriented researchers to bring their findings to light and discuss them, and then link the research results with practical evidence-based strategies that we can all use. To help us do that, my distinguished guest is Dr. Brian Zhik. He earned his PhD from Yale University in 1999 and currently is professor and head of the Department of Linguistics at the University of British Columbia and is a senior scientist at Yale's Haskins Laboratories in New Haven, Connecticut. Notably, he is a Guggenheim Fellow, awarded in 2017 in the field of linguistics. As a Guggenheim Fellow, Dr. Zhik primarily works with top interdisciplinary experts to develop and extend his body-based approach to speech. He's also a Fellow of the Royal Society of Canada and a Fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. His research and his teaching focus is to understand the physical mechanisms of speech production and their interactions, I love this, with perception, phonology, and phonetics in normal, disordered, and children's speech across languages. Among other things, his research has involved developing techniques for applying ultrasound imaging technology to speech research, protocols for studying tactile perception of speech, very exciting, methods for observing speech motor behavior and speech planning, and biomechanical simulation. Specifically, he shows us how we feel speech information through our skin. Dr. Zhik and his team have identified and named previously unnamed functional body parts, which is amazing. He's published hundreds of papers within a wide range of distinguished journals. No doubt, wherever he goes, he is the smartest man in the room. Prior to our podcast, Dr. Zhik, you encouraged me to call you by your first name. So welcome to the Speech Link, Brian.
Thanks so much, Shar. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I am thrilled and honored that you're here.
Honored to be here.
Great. Thank you.
Very cool opportunity.
Great. Well, I first became aware of and acquainted with you and your research from your March 1917 article, Speaking Tongues Are Actively Braced. And I have to admit, when I read that and it was nice and short, to the point. I could understand it. I thought, whoa, I love this. I absolutely love this. So I even kind of wrote a little blog on it and shared it with other therapists that are on my mailing list, at least. And I've actually just, you know, I've been focusing on lateral margin stabilization, which equates to bracing, for many, many years. And I feel as a therapist that it is just one of the critical pieces to generate in our kids that have speech issues. So I've just been so excited to talk with you about that and other things. So, you know, as we get going here, you know, I definitely would like us to talk about, for you to talk about the lateral bracing piece. So we can either start there, or if there is a broader range of speech postures or oral postures that you would like to address, I'll kind of leave that open to you. Where would be best for us to start?
Well, I mean, at least just as a general overview, I mean, first of all, again, thanks so much for having me. And it's really exciting to make, I love making these links and, you know, making the link in particular between clinical practice and the kind of basic research that we do in our lab. Good. That's really what gives it meaning. And it's really gratifying to connect with people who are finding ways to use these sort of, you know, just really basic observations about how the body works and take them into practice. So really appreciate the opportunity. Yeah. So, I mean, as far as thinking about posture in general, you know, there is a whole field and multiple fields that really deal with posture, you know, anything having to do with, you know, motor control and biomechanics and so on. There's lots and lots of kinesiology, lots of people who have been interested in posture for many years. Unfortunately, that's not really the way we have traditionally thought about speech so much. And so there's this real disconnect between the way we think about how the body works for most kinds of movements, you know, sort of gross body movements, and the way we think about how the body works for speech. And really, I think it's really important that we bring these together. And one of the key missing pieces is this idea of posture, I believe. And the reason it's so important is that if you think about any speech movement, you know, we all think about speech movements. And when, you know, if you think about any communicative movement, it's all built, every movement is built on a substrate of posture. Just like if you're, you know, if you are standing and, you know, or sitting or whatever and reaching for something, if you tried to understand that motion from the point of view of just thinking about the body just with no activation, we never think about that, right? I mean, we don't ever start a movement from just lying collapsed on the floor. And by the same token, you know, the vocal tract, you know, we hold the vocal tract in a posture that's really the whole idea with postures is that they're anti-gravity, right? They help us fight against gravity pulling us down. The way you hold your head, the way you hold your soft palate, the way you hold your tongue, your jaw, it all involves active muscle activation, right? So we're using those muscles to keep ourselves in a position where we can start talking. And if we don't have that down, we can talk all day about the movements, the particular speech movements. But if we don't have that sort of basic posture down, we haven't gotten started yet. So
Good. The one thing that keeps going through my mind, you're talking about posture and you know, we talk about placement and so on for the tongue, but a really big piece of my therapy has been the oral resting position. And, you know, we don't have to necessarily talk about that, but it really kind of gives that position or the posture so that the tongue is at the ready as far as positioning to move into speech placements and speech movements and speech stabilization and mobilization. So that's kind of how I think about it. But continue to sort of expand on that. This is really interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I sometimes have said that we're kind of linguocentric when we talk about speech. You know, we love talking about the tongue. I definitely will spend a lot of time focusing on the tongue here, but I do also thinking about thinking about how you hold your head or how you hold your soft palate. The soft palate's a great example. Like we think about velopharyngeal port control and, you know, we kind of take for granted that when you're speaking almost all the time, you're maintaining this velopharyngeal port closure. And we think about it relative to specific sounds often, but really that's just a, you know, again, it's the same idea, right? You're maintaining a constant posture throughout speech. And when you make a nasal sound, I mean, there's great EMG evidence from the 70s, Pierre Bongerell, that shows that in many cases, when you're producing a nasal sound, an active nasal sound, you're actually not activating anything. You're deactivating that posture. You're relaxing those muscles that are keeping the soft palate in place to keep the velopharyngeal port closed. And that relaxation is what makes a nasal sound work. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, like if you think of it from that point of view, it's like, well, if you don't have the posture right, and of course, there's a whole many, a whole subfield dedicated to thinking about velopharyngeal port closure and nasalization and nasalize and all that stuff. So don't need to, you know, especially with a speech pathology audience, we don't, you know, in many ways don't need to convince anybody of that. But at the same time, you know, if you're not starting from the point of view that this posture is there as sort of a substrate, then, you know, understanding what happens when we make an active movement away from it, it's very hard to make sense of, right? So taking that over to sort of how you think about the tongue, it's very similar, right? We can think about how you place the tongue in the mouth when you're about to speak. Is in many ways we've learned a lot from looking at the tongue when we're not speaking. So that is to say, you know, in between utterances, we hold our tongues in this very particular position where the sides of the tongue are raised often when you're in a ready position to speak. And then we maintain that posture throughout speech. And we maintain this sort of closure along the sides of the teeth and palate. And that creates, if you think about that, with the curved palate on top and the sides of the tongue touching on the sides, that creates a tube. And that's what we've been, you know, in our work, have been calling the aeroacoustic tube, which is what we speak through. That's the tube. When you think about that tube that you study in your acoustics classes and whatever, that's the tube, right? It's created by that posture of the tongue maintaining this contact on the sides. And of course, we don't always maintain that contact. We pull it down for something like making a lateral sound like L. But otherwise, pretty much you're just keeping your tongue up there all the time. And that's not the way we've always thought about how speech works.
Right. Well, I think we need to think about it that way.
I know you think about it that way, yeah, but most people don't. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. When we're doing therapy, a lot of times we, you know, we'll just sort of present the sound to the child, and the child is sort of at will to try and find that placement. But other times, and especially, you know, when we are focusing on a more oral sensory motor approach, we want that child to definitely have a sense of, here's where the sides of the tongue anchor. Mm-hmm. Here's where they go. And I think, you know, in fact, I remember, this was years ago, I was doing therapy in Southern California in a little school district called Romoland. And this little boy came in and he had this, you know, extreme lateral lisp on several different sibilants. And he'd been in speech for many, many years. And no one had ever said, here's where your tongue goes. And we talked about that lateral margin contact, the bracing piece, and a couple of other things. And, you know, we did some therapy and so on with him. And I'm going to say he graduated by Thanksgiving. Okay. And he said, nobody ever told me where my tongue was supposed to go. Up within the dental arch, sides of the tongue touching the insides of the top back teeth. And I love the terminology. What did you say? An aero, what dynamic?
Aeroacoustic tube. So AERO acoustic.
Acoustic tube. Yeah. Okay. So it creates.
It's that tube that we push air through.
Yeah.
To where, you know, where resonance happens, you know, and where if we don't have that tube right, you know, think of all the sounds that you make in speech. Almost all of them require that we're manipulating the shape and dimensions of this tube. And we talk about that in our acoustics classes, and yet somehow it doesn't make the crossover to looking at the physiology that way and looking at the anatomy that way.
Yeah. So very, very important.
I can throw in one other really interesting little tidbit, which is
Throw it in. We're ready to catch.
That basic posture that forms that tube is almost identical to the posture that we use for the same tube that we use for food when we're chewing and swallowing. So the oral phase, the initial part of the oral phase of swallow, when you're holding on to that, the preparatory phase, when you're holding on to that food bolus and just about to initiate the peristalsis to get the food down your into your pharynx, that shape is almost exactly the same as making something, well, essentially the same as making a click, you know, that kind of sound. And it's very, very similar. So if you just pull the back of the tongue down, and you know, once you've started that peristalsis process, now you're making something very much like a T or a D or an M, right? So you're making a closure all the way around the front and including that bracing on the sides. And so all you have to do is pull the tip down, right? And now you've got that tube, right? So that's the tube we're talking about, really. It's the same tube that's evolved mm-hmm. for feeding and swallowing.
Sure.
Is what we're co-opting, if you like,
yeah.
for speech.
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Since we're on swallowing, if we could just stay on this for just a couple minutes.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There is something that is quite abstract, and it's intraoral suctioning. And it's the mm-hmm. process of, or the action of what we do to actually pull the saliva or the food or the incoming liquid on top of the tongue and within that tube so that we can generate that peristalsis action to make it go down. Mm-hmm. So have you studied much of that intraoral suctioning? Because that is so very abstract. And I know that you do. I mean, I think, don't you have to have the lateral contact and the front part
absolutely.
Of the tongue lowers and it creates absolutely. A negative pressure? What's going on in there?
Yeah. So
for that?
It's, I mean, you know, and again, this is something we've simulated, we've worked on, but you know, I cannot say I'm not a swallowing clinician or a swallowing expert, but essentially as far as I understand it, again, it's the same basic mechanism. You know, when a baby makes those clicking sounds, those tongue clicking sounds, and the same suction that you use for nursing is that suction. It's not a suction between, you know, you're closing all the way around the sides, but you're also closing in the back, not all the way down to, you know, you've got to close somewhere to create that suction, right? And the closure is not
right.
down at the larynx or whatever, right? The closure is no. at the back of the tongue, the oropharyngeal isthmus. Again, that's exactly the same suction that makes a click sound work. So mm-hmm. you've heard click languages, you know, those kinds
yeah.
of sounds, right?
Right.
Those sounds are produced with the same suction, with that same suction, right? And that's by closing off the sides and the back and then pulling down the tongue in the middle mm-hmm. so that creates a vacuum.
So, okay. Okay. Yeah.
And,
creating
and again,
a vacuum.
That's,
okay.
That's that little cup that we can create with our tongue to hold food or to hold air and to manipulate, mm-hmm. to manipulate resonance, right?
Mm-hmm.
In speech.
And lips have to be closed.
Well,
or no.
You have to have an anterior closure.
Well, to create the
right.
suction, I guess you don't have to have lips closed. But if you are gathering something that's inside of your
exactly.
mouth and you want to get it on
exactly.
top of the tongue to make it go down. Okay.
So if you think of that in terms of click sounds, you can make the closure, the anterior closure with the tongue tip, right? Or you can make that anterior closure with the lips, right? And that's
okay.
this, it, again, it's you've got the same closure in the back and on the sides, and you're just changing where you make the closure in the front. Of course, when you've
okay.
got food and you're chewing, you need your lips to be closed, right? So the food's
right.
not coming out of your mouth.
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
that you can create the suction that's going to pull that food into the center.
Right, right. I've always noticed that, you know, that there's a suction over the front or there's
mm-hmm.
a suction around the sides, depending on where the contents are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So if you're,
and
yeah,
you know, one of the funniest things about this is that, you know, if you read a book about swallowing, say, and you read or a paper about swallowing, and you read a book or a paper about phonetics, the tongue, you know, how the tongue works for speech, you would think you were talking about two different parts of the body or two whole different bodies. I mean, they don't look anything alike, right? And that is to say these very three-dimensional structures that we talk about with swallowing, and where we know we need to talk about the sides of the tongue, and we need to talk about suction, and we need to you know, talk about where the closures are happening so that we can really understand where, how this food bolus is getting manipulated. That's just not the way that we have talked about speech production typically. So, and once you go there, right, once you let it kind of get a little bit more complicated, the way we think about our speech models, then it's a very, very small step. It's no step at all to start thinking about posture and thinking tongue posture and thinking about how we hold the tongue during speech on, you know, against the sides of the side
right,
of the palate.
Right. You know, I read a book years ago and I can't remember, it's back there, but it was on whole body movement. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they emphasized was stabilization and mobilization. Whether you're, you know, shushy and skiing down a hill, you've got to have your, you know, your core stabilization, and you've got to have other areas of stabilization internal, and you've got your, you know, your poles for your external stabilization. If you're dancing, you've got the same thing. And it's just all about stabilization and mobilization, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, I love that. I love that terminology. It's not a terminology I had heard before that we use in the lab, but I might start using it.
There you go. There you go. You heard it here.
I'll have to look
yeah,
that
right.
up.
Yeah, right. Oh, gosh. Well, that's so very interesting. Now, you said there, like, you know, there's a question here of where do speech postures come from? And you mentioned that as one of the things that maybe you'd like to talk about. Is that something that you think would be helpful for us?
Well, I think what I meant by that was what I anticipated that with thinking about swallowing. And when I talk about where it comes from, I'm really thinking both in terms of ontogeny and phylogeny, that these are feeding and swallowing is, you know, speech is brand new, right, on the evolutionary time scale of where we are as humans. And when you look at the structures that we have to work with to communicate with, if we're going to use the human body as a communicative device and we're going to make sounds with these structures that are here for, you know, feeding and swallowing and breathing and also, you know, these other functions, it really helps to think about how we're making use of the structures that are there. And I don't just mean the anatomical structures, but the functional structures. So, you know, this idea of being able to create a tube that we can manipulate, to form a tube that we can manipulate and be able to manipulate sound resonance with that same tube, to manipulate airflow with that tube. And again, that that's something that I guess when I say, you know, to think about kind of, it's interesting to think about where these things come from. That is to say, speech is such a newcomer on the scene in the grand scheme of sort of where we are as humans. And, you know, most of these structures that we have are present in every other mammal. And, you know, as far as like feeding and swallowing structures and things like that, breathing and so on, you know, using the oral tract for these functions. And then you look at babies, we've, you know, a lot of people have talked about, you know, in linguistics have talked about the blank slate and all of that. And we're anything but blank slates. You know, we come into the world, first of all, already knowing how to vocalize. You know, the very first time you take air into your lungs as a human, you know, the first time it's not amniotic fluid, but air, it comes out with vocalization, right? So we don't have to learn how to do that. We don't have to learn how to, if you can survive as a human feeding and swallowing and suckling, you can use that same, again, those same structures to turn them around and be making speech sounds. So there's been some really interesting work out of Montreal, I don't want to forget the name, really interesting work looking at the crossovers between, like, you know, therapeutically, when you work on improving swallowing, you see improvements in speech. And when you work on speech, you see improvements in swallowing. And it's, again, it's because of this. It's because it's, you know, shared physical mechanisms, shared neural substrates, and so on. So
are you talking about in the very young years, like toddlers?
Yeah. So, I mean,
or even before the first year.
Well, I mean, even in the womb, we're producing speech-like configurations. We're doing, you know, swallowing, we're doing clicking, we're doing, you know, lip rounding and spreading and lip closure. all of these movements that we produce that, you know, that we can, as far as we can see what's going on in the womb, functionally, we're making all kinds of speech-like movements with those taking amniotic fluid in and out. You know, we're practicing that bracing of the tongue, that manipulating fluid. And air is just another fluid, right? I mean, if you ask a chemical engineer or a mechanical engineer, you know, it's all fluid flow, you know, whether we're talking about amniotic fluid or air, the mechanisms are much the same. So we're practicing in the womb all these movements, which is why we come out of the womb already knowing how to use our vocal tracts for things like vocalizing.
Okay. All right. Would you like to talk with us about the speech development piece a little bit?
I think it gets into a territory where I think what we can say is that if you get the postures down right, if you're not having issues with the basic mechanisms and feeding, swallowing, suckling, those things, breathing, vocalizing, you know, all the usual stuff for babies, that you have a good start into speech. That doesn't guarantee that you're going to get everything right, because what we have to do after that is, as you're learning to speak, you need to take those structures that are already very, very complex movements. I mean, a swallow is 25 different sets of muscles working. You know, it's incredibly, you know, in a very specific, as you'll know, and many of the listeners will know, very specific firing order and pattern. If you're not getting that right, you know, you're out of luck, right? So you really need to have that right. Now, to use those mechanisms for speech, to be able to make a velopharyngeal pore closure, which is, again, part of swallowing, you know, for example, you might be able to do it for swallowing, but you may not be able to differentiate. I mean, the word that the researchers tend to use around this is differentiation, to take a component of a complex set of movements, a complex maneuver, and sort of differentiate it up, pull it out, and to separate that out as a sort of separate controllable movement that you can intentionally control. And that's, you know, if you can manage that, you know, so if you've got all the swallowing and feeding and all that stuff in place, that's a good start, but you're not there yet, right? So you have to be able to manipulate those intentionally and separately to get some of these, to get.
So would you say that, you know, you have a child that is babbling, which is basically jaw driven, and you have a few of the corner vowels that are being produced, not necessarily, you know, four vowels, but those are sounds that are just basically emerging, because that's what happens when you move your jaw in that way. And you keep mouthing and adding that sensory piece and discerning the different movements and the compressions and the contractions and so on, and all the, you know, the left and the right and the up and the down that the tongue can do, and the compressed the lips and so on. And would you say that those types of things really help to move that differentiation piece forward? And then as you get into speech, as you get toward that first year, and then afterwards, the jaw takes kind of a back seat, and the tongue learns to sort of differentiate and move in that controlled way and come full circle here to generate the lateral margin stabilization and the bracing and so on. So that, when would you say that children have that bracing piece, and that, you know, when does that come in, do you think, developmentally?
I can't say for sure, because, you know, that I think that's an empirical question that really hasn't been fully explored. So,
okay, well, there you go.
We're working on it.
Okay. Oh, good. Good. Let us know.
But what I can say, you know, again, is that, you know, bracing, if you can swallow, if you can suckle, you can brace. The difficulty is when you, and we've all seen this, right, in clinical settings where, you know, you can know how to do something, but then transferring that over to other contexts can be really challenging.
That's right. That's called doing therapy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. My definition of therapy is trying to get somebody to do something that they can't do. Yeah, there you go. So, okay, let's move on. And I know the other day you and I had talked a little bit about the muscular hydrostat issues and so on, and how the mid-tongue contracts. Is that something that you would like to talk with us about? Because that mid-tongue contraction really alters that tube. Mm-hmm. and that helps to elevate the front part of the tongue.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. Let's see, where were we with the hydrolung? I know we did talk about the hydrolung. I mean, the tongue. One of the things that we do think about the tongue, and the tongue is very often talked about as a muscular hydrostat. One of the things that's a little bit different from other kinds of muscular hydrostats, like trunks and tentacles and things like that, is that the tongue is with a true muscular hydrostat, your stabilization comes from intrinsic muscle tension.
Okay.
So you have a hydrostatic skeleton, mm-hmm. effectively, right? And that's how a trunk works, or a tentacle, right? So you get out, mm-hmm. towards, you know, halfway down the tentacle, there's no palate, right? There's no bone that you're bracing.
No hard tissue.
Against,
yeah.
Right? You're just bracing, like, you know, you're bracing muscle against muscle, mm-hmm. right? And with the tongue, the musculature of the tongue is different. It's one thing that's really, really interesting is if you look at the tongue of something like an anteater, where the tongue spends a lot of time outside of the mouth, does most of its functioning outside of the mouth, the musculature is set up like a trunk or a tentacle. It's much more radial. And as soon as you look at, you know, if you look at related mammals and so on, that where the tongue is not quite so long and the tongue is actually spending most of its time in the mouth and right down to humans, say down to humans.
Or up.
I'm being evolutionarily incorrect or something.
There you go. It's okay.
But, you know, you look at tongues that spend most of their time in the mouth and the musculature is set up really differently. The musculature is much more lateral. Has much more of a sort of lateral component, and the muscles are laid out so that the tongue is built to interface with these hard structures, right? So in a sense, the tongue is really part of a tongue palate combination, right? A tongue palate sort of co-evolved structure, a single structure,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. that way of thinking about the tongue is, again, it requires sort of a departure from thinking about the tongue as this free-floating tentacle in our mouths, which it is not, right? You look at another sort of concern, you know, a sort of maybe a problematic kind of way that we describe the vocal tract is with this mid-sagittal slice. You know, you see the slice with the head turned to the side, and you can see the outline of the tongue from the side and all that. And it looks like the tongue is just kind of this free-floating animal in our mouths. But it's not free floating at all, right? It's always braced, or at least as you say, sort of has a resting posture, or a stabilized posture. There are, you know, different ways to talk about that. But the tongue is symmetrical along, you know, it's symmetrical to the midline, but what's happening on the sides, even though it's often symmetrical to one another, it's not like what's going on in the midline.
There you go.
So, you know, what's happening on the sides, you know, you can see, you know, it's really fun to use an ultrasound. If you have access to an ultrasound machine, you can hold an ultrasound transducer under your chin, hold it sideways so you're getting a coronal slice, and watch what the sides of the tongue do. You can talk along, say whatever you like. The middle of the tongue is going up and down like crazy, like we're used to seeing, right? But the sides of the tongue are just kind of sitting there. Unless you're making a bunch of L's, the sides of the tongue are just sitting there. They're just stable. And that's really what we're talking about with this tongue posture, this lateral posture that you've been talking about, Sean.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what about vowels? Don't we have a few vowels that release?
There are a couple of vowels. So if you're producing a low vowel, a really open vowel like ah,
yeah.
Then it is. So that's the about. I think it depends on the vowel, but for say ah does it the most. Up to like maybe, depending on the person, 40% of the time, you might pull the tongue away from the sides when you're making an ah. And it's just for those low open vowels.
Mm-hmm.
And that's again because it's for those vowels, it's totally okay to let air, to use those side, those buccal cavities, right? Like you do for L. You know, the reason that L sounds different and ah and so on sound different is that you're letting air, sort of letting resonance go, you know, letting some of the resonance happen in those side cavities. Mm-hmm. And you're doing that because you're lowering the whole tongue on the jaw, and that creates this really open sound. And that, I mean, that's how we can tell it's an open sound. It sounds like a bigger cavity because you've got a, you know, as soon as you open up that aeroacoustic tube, now you've got a much bigger tube all of a sudden, boom, instantly, right? And so that makes a really different kind of sound. And so we use that to make that contrast. But for all the other sounds, yeah, and for all the other vowels, we're keeping those, keeping the size of the tongue in that posture, that resting posture.
I kind of learned about this bracing piece, stabilization piece, anchorage piece via palatography. That's where I started, you know, back with Samuel Fletcher and so on, and others that have continued his work. And I just, you know, and you can just see, or you get a sense of that contact of the sides of the tongue where it's touching. Now, would you say that there is a variation among people as far as, and I'm sure that the variability perhaps comes from the width of the dental arch, the height of the palatal vault, the amount of, or the level of range of motion and release of the tongue. So would you say that there is a variance between the amount of lingual surface-to-surface contact, and maybe it's just touching the sides of the teeth, or maybe even just the cusps? I don't know if you can get away with that.
Yep.
As far as maybe elevating a little bit more and touching the perimeter of the palate?
Definitely,
would you say that there's variance there depending on the rest of the structures?
Yeah. So one of the things that happens is that when you, particularly if you're using palatography, if you're using electropalatography, the palatal inserts that you use for those arrays of electrodes are, if you look at those, usually it's just it's like a retainer, right? You put it in and it's just the part of the palate that's inside of the teeth, right? And that's where the sort of the surface of it starts. And then inside of that, by half a centimeter or whatever, or sometimes a few millimeters, inside of that is where the electrodes begin. So that is to say, like, if you're bracing or, you know, doing this lateral contact stabilization against the teeth primarily, or against just inside the teeth, just at the very edge of the palate, you're not even going to see that on an EPG palate.
Yeah.
And so I think, so what's happened is that over the years in the research, you've had researchers noticing that, hey, this sound, you know, this N sound or this K sound is braced. It's really interesting. The tongue's really sort of like, you know, closing along the sides. And then they've, you know, they've said, well, you know, it's really sporadic for other sounds. And when you actually, So one of the things that we did in our the 2017 paper that you were talking about was we looked at some old archival EPG data from the K allometrics. I don't know if you remember K allometrics back in the day. K, which was purchased by Pentax, K used to make a palate, a soft palate or a hard palate insert that where the plastic, the retainer, went right over the teeth and the electrodes went right along the inner edge of the teeth, right along the molars. And so when you look at that data, it's completely different.
Is it really?
Totally different. You can see, so you can see the tongue staying in contact with those electrodes the whole time you're talking.
Wow. Yeah. So how thick really were those electrodes? I mean, they were just very, very thin.
Very thin electrodes. Yeah.
They could hardly feel them.
Yeah. So it's just like a really, really, really thin layer of plastic molded to your teeth that just kind of goes right over your teeth.
Okay.
And embedded in those are these tiny little exposed metal bits, and those would pick up the contact with your tongue.
Okay. So a lot of times we are just stabilizing against the insides of the top back teeth to one degree or another.
Yeah. Yeah. And you have to, you know, it depends on your dentition. It depends on the size of the oral cavity. It depends on things that we still don't understand exactly. It also is different from one side to the other. We talked a little bit about tonguedness.
Yes.
That, you know, we've got a group, and here, you know, also all through this work, I really have to recognize the work of some of the folks in my lab. Yadong Liu has been working on posture experiments, these tongue posture experiments, bracing and so on. And Arian Shami has been looking at, again, these tongue postures with astronauts and so on. returning from space, because again, gravity's changing, right? So this is a great place to look at what happens when the functional requirements change and how does the tongue respond. So, but one of the things that we're finding, you know, is that the two sides of the tongue behave differently. So everybody seems to be tongued, you know, left tongued or right tongued. So tonguedness really is a thing. And we don't know exactly what it correlates to, but we're pretty sure that it's not correlating with handedness.
Interesting.
So far, with the number of participants we've looked at, there isn't a correlation between tonguedness and handedness.
That is interesting. So, and I know you mentioned the other day, you said, I am not a therapist. That's what you said. And then I said, I am not a researcher. But what you have done as far as identifying very tangible speech production components really offers therapists a goal and something that we can really focus on with our kids. Through the years, I've used different, you know, tools and so on, maybe different textures or applying flavors or you know, whatever, and just trying to get in there and to palpate and to stroke the sides of the tongue, stroke the perimeter of the palate and the sides of the teeth, and just, you know, and encourage them to match and to feel it. And then also encouraging them to maintain their lips closed, tongue up, jaw gently relaxed, their postures, you know, their whole oral resting posture, which provides that immediate, hey, my tongue is in that position and all I have to do is just spread a little bit, contract the mid and move the front. Mm-hmm. And so, but they're in that position of elevating that tongue up within the dental arch. Mm-hmm. So your information is just invaluable. And you know, whether people do this kind of thing or not, even if they just say, honey, you need to get your tongue up in here, mm-hmm. take a look at my tongue, or here I have a, you know, a mouth model. Here's where your tongue goes. Close your eyes, put your tongue up in there and feel it and move your tongue and feel the sides of your teeth. You know, anything that we can do to really enable that child to have a sense of that position and then to do it about 800 more times.
Do it 1,000 times. And that's
right. Do it 1,000 times or more. Yeah, exactly. Because it's not just a cognitive thing. It is a motoric thing. And it's not like we can say, honey, would you mind not talking for the next 3 months? You know, and just sort of get rid of all of those things that you're doing. And we'll put all put this on top of it. Yeah, that doesn't work. So it is a process. Do you have any other things that you've heard or perhaps that you've thought of that would be beneficial for us to think about, to focus on our kids with it and adults, as far as, you know, the research and the findings that you have come up with? Anything else that you would like to emphasize with us?
Well, yeah. So following on some of that, one of the tools that we've worked with a lot, I mentioned ultrasound, and I did a lot of work in the 2000s with Barbara May Bernhardt, who is a clinician and was in the School of Audiology and Speech Sciences at UBC when I got to UBC. And we spent a lot of time doing both EPG and ultrasound. But one of the things that she and many of her students have really developed is, you know, approaches to using ultrasound it's one of the best tools for visualizing what the tongue is doing. And not everybody has access to an ultrasound machine, but surprisingly many of us do. And as well, like, it's completely changed. When I first started, you know, an ultrasound machine was like a big golf cart that you'd roll around and it costs $150,000. You know, now ultrasound machines, you know, you can get a little tiny portable ultrasound machine. You can even get a transducer that plugs into your computer and you can use that to visualize the tongue. That can, you know, those can run a couple $1,000. So it's gotten much more affordable. And as well, like if you have access to a hospital or a clinic that has an ultrasound machine, you know, play around with it. Rest it against the, you know, under your chin. And start seeing what it looks like. If you haven't done it, you know, if you haven't used ultrasound for speech, you know, see what your tongue looks like as it moves around. And you can really see what the sides of the tongue, you know, if you hold it sideways, you can really see what the sides of the tongue are doing. And it's we have definitely found with kids who have difficulty with the other kinds of feedback, they've been in speech therapy for, you know, years and years, they've seen it all. And you give them a new kind of feedback through a different modality, give them a visual, you know, visual feedback of their tongue. And many kids, not all, but many kids respond really well to that and, you know, are really able to look at that and say, oh, okay, this is what you're talking about. The sides of my tongue are here. I need to hold them. You know, it's something to think about. As you say, it's also something you can use a popsicle stick and stick it in there and feel when you're making that contact. You know, there are lots of things that you can do to start making use of that. The other thing that jumped to mind as you were talking was that this is something that's different from language to language a little bit. Every language does it, but the way you hold that posture that you hold your articulators in, even when you're not speaking, is different from language to language. That's why, you know, you can tell if somebody's a French speaker or an English speaker, you know, sometimes just by the way they hold the way they hold their mouths or something, right? And that's also true inside, it's true of the tongue and so on. So this is something to think about if you're in areas of therapy where you're working with people who are learning different languages and so on in second language acquisition. It can be really useful to talk about learning the posture independent of learning the speech targets.
Right. That is what I call the oral resting posture. It's what you do with lips, tongue, and jaw when you're not using them. At least that's my, you know, that's my terminology. Are you familiar with where more Latino kids rest their tongue? Is it more forward or does it vary as far as where they're from?
Again, it depends on the language. We've looked at French and Japanese and English, of course. But, you know, one thing I can say for sure, if you're thinking of something like the trill, you know, the way you produce a trill is by stabilizing on the sides and making that closure in the middle, but making it really loose and keeping the tongue in the middle loose so that when you push air through, it starts to vibrate. And that's, you think about the differentiation of the tongue that you need to, the control of different parts of the tongue that you need to master for that to work. It's no wonder that it's a late acquired sound and sometimes a difficult sound.
And a pointer there.
Yeah, exactly. Most R's. A pointer there, something to think about is if you are working with kids who are trying to acquire the R or adults, this is also true, you know, in theater and so on. If you try just hanging your head between your knees, tilting your head upside down, and then letting your tongue loosely rest against the palate and then blowing air through that and practicing the trill that way, you'll find that most people find that quite easy because you're not having to master that posture and master getting the right sort of tension in the tongue. And you can just let the tongue rest and then you can practice tilting your head up to different degrees to get better and better at sort of maintaining the posture while you keep them.
Well, there you go. That's a therapy technique, Ryan.
it's a tip.
Yeah, that's a tip. There you go. Well, we do have a couple of comments and I think a question here from Lauren. She says, so interesting. I see a lot of similarities between what you're discussing and basic concepts that prompt uses as for the bracing and the stabilization piece. Are you familiar with prompt at all?
I'm not.
It's so okay if you're not.
This is good. Yeah, I'd love to
hear about
it.
But it's been around a while and it's a good program. Yeah, great. And then this is Jonelle. Do you recommend oral motor exercises to strengthen, I guess, the posture and placement abilities or to help with awareness of oral posture?
Again, I'm not speaking as a therapist here, but I can certainly say that I know that many therapists do that. And one thing that I would say that we've seen is that you were talking earlier about the feedback that we get. We did a study some years back where we were looking at the sensory acuity of the tongues of different speakers and finding that people with high degrees of sensory acuity in their tongues actually were producing cleaner speech sounds like, you know, S, for example, or you know, they had a much tighter, narrower spectrum of noise that they were able to control with the S, for example. There's definitely, it's not just about, so when you're doing those kinds of motor exercises, oftentimes I think we think of that as, you know, somehow like weightlifting, like training the muscles, the muscle strength. And I think sometimes it's also just training the sensory feedback that we're getting from being in that position. And of course the muscles have to learn that as well, but there's a give and take, right, between this constant feedback loop that we're getting. And when you have points of contact, we get sensory feedback from those that you know, we have to learn what to do with that information. You know, that information's coming in as fluent speakers of human languages. Most of us aren't even aware of the sensation of our tongue touching and rubbing against the sides of the palate. But when you start paying attention to it, it's like, oh yeah, that's happening all the time. You know? And so I think again, like, you know, sometimes that practice is as much about, it's about learning to make the link between the what our sensory systems are telling us and what our motor systems are being asked to do.
Yeah. You know, it is so refreshing to hear you, to hear a researcher talk about sensation as far as intraoral sensation. Mm-hmm. Because every time I see an article, not every time, but most of the times when I see an article come up and they mention the word sensation, they're talking about auditory sensation. Mm-hmm. And I think we've kind of dropped the ball. You know, in regards to intraoral sensation. So I, you know, boy, keep doing that. I think it's so extremely important. Also, Janelle, just to sort of add something here to what you were talking about, from my perspective and working with my kids through the years, and especially, you know, emphasizing the external stabilization and the internal stabilization, you know, the muscular hydrostat maneuver there, what I have found is that the kids that have difficulty generating the gradations, because if you contract a little bit, you know, your tongue goes up a little bit. If you contract more, I found that it goes up more. And if they have difficulty with those gradations, is what I have found, is that those are kids that have those really flaccid tongues. Now, this is something that, Brian, you need to get in there and figure that one out. But I have seen kids that have that, it just doesn't bend. They just don't generate that mid-tongue contraction. And so the kids that I have worked on, that I have done strength tasks to generate tone, to hopefully generate some endurance, because speech is an endurance task. But I have worked on generating the, using strength tasks so that I can get to mid-tongue contraction, because we don't need strength, really. We don't need, you know, weightlifter, and we don't do excessive strong maneuvers when we're speaking. That's my rationale, you know, looking at the tongue. And if we can get some good mid-tongue contraction, then we're probably okay. But we have Beth Ann, who said, yes, it's an integral part of my therapy program for my RTIC clients. So yes, it all works together there. Yeah, definitely. Do you have some closing comments? Anything that you didn't say that you wanted to be sure and say? I don't want to negate that. Is there anything else that you would like us to hear?
No, I think really just, again, thanks so much for having me. And I, again, really, really appreciate the opportunity to connect with a community of clinicians and really, you know, make those connections. I think that's where, you know, the connections between basic research and practice are so important. And so often it takes too long for the discoveries that are, you know, and I mean, speech is an area where we're still right at the beginning of really understanding these mechanisms. And, you know, so we're making new discoveries every day, and it's really exciting. And you know, so it's really important that we keep those lines of communication open. So I really appreciate this forum and the context for being able to do that.
Oh, well, thank you so much. I just appreciate you and your focus on these really highly practical areas. I mean, these are things that every single speech pathologist that works with speech disordered kids needs. This is it. So, you know, I'm just so grateful for what you're doing, and just grateful that you are willing to come on here and share your knowledge and be with all of us therapists. Just well, really appreciate me. That. Yeah. Yes. Well, now I know that you have your information. Was it your ultrasound information on a specific website? And is there any other things that we need to know, websites that we need to go to, an email address that we need that you would like to share or not? It's up to you. Any other resources like that?
Well, I'm easy to find. There's only one Brian Jick in the field. So Jick is an unusual enough name that it's easy to find. But yeah, my lab website, hopefully we're just about to post some new research pages. So hopefully that'll get posted in the next few days here. And that should help. But again, our work is really focused on just the basics of how the body is used as a speech, as a communication device. So that covers potentially a lot of ground. There are a lot of pieces to that, but if there are pieces that are that people are finding interesting and are seeing applications for, we're really excited to hear about them.
So do we just Google Brian Jick research, or is there something specific?
Our website, my lab is called the Interdisciplinary Speech Research Lab. Actually, it's in the midst of shifting to the Integrated Speech Research Lab, but okay. It's still ISRL. If you Google UBC ISRL or UBC Brian Jick, you'll find me. And ISRL, the Interdisciplinary Speech Research Lab. So yeah.
Okay, great. And then is there an email that you would like to share?
jick@mail.ubc.ca is my email address. So
do it again.
Jick, G-I-C-K, at mail, M-A-I-L, dot ubc.ca.
.ca for Canada. Got it. Great. Thank you. Well, you're getting lots of kudos here. Andrea says, wonderful episode. Thank you for all the information. Well, thank you so very, very much for sharing all your wonderful insight and your knowledge and being willing to come on here with all of us. I greatly, greatly appreciate it. You are amazing, amazingly knowledgeable and just focused on doing really practical, interesting things. And we all appreciate it. I love it that you're part of that you're sort of inching into the clinical world. I think it's great. Also, I would like to thank all of you for being here and for tuning in and for continuing to get the word out about the SpeechLink podcast, where you not only learn practical information, you earn CEUs. And in a few days, the audio version of this podcast will be available on all of the free podcast apps like Apple Podcast and TuneIn and Podbean and so on. And do know, I greatly appreciate your positive comments and your reviews and your positive support. Also, as you may know, the SpeechLink meets every other Thursday at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. And the next time that we meet is October 7, same time. And Shari Gross, M-A-C-C-C, S-L-P, will share her very much needed topic, selective mutism, real world info and answers for SLPs. And also, as you know, when we wrap up, just log into your SpeechTherapyPD.com account, take the quiz, do the evaluation, and print out your certificate. Do know you are greatly appreciated. And thank you so much for all that you do for your therapy kids. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye. I'm thrilled you tuned into the SpeechLink. I hope it was helpful. Just leave a quick review and subscribe to be part of a select group that receives every episode. For CEUs, go to SpeechTherapyPD.com. And for everything else, visit SharpOSharp.com. There's free materials, articles, books, and my blog, Therapy Matters. Thank you for all you do. See you next time.
Remember to visit SpeechTherapyPD.com to earn 0.1 ASHA CEUs for this episode and to see our library of over 1,400 courses for all things SLP.